Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Deepwater, a program on religion, culture, and public affairs. The theme of the program is that we, as faith communities, are only in our social ministries up to our ankles, and we ought to be over our heads, hence the name Deepwater. Our panelists today are Rabbi Jim Morrell of Temple B'nai Torah in Bellevue, Jeff Siddiqui, a member of the Greater Puget Sound Muslim Community, and Sharon Mo, Senior Minister of University Temple United Methodist Church here in the University District of Seattle. My name is Don McKenzie. I'm Minister and Head of Staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ. The topic before us today is the environment and the relationship between public policy and the environment, and also the relationship between those two things and theological reflection. And I want to begin with a quote, or two quotes, from an article from the New Yorker magazine of November 18, 2002, a piece written by Elizabeth Colbert called Sound of a Tree Falling, where she comments on the actions of the Bush administration vis-a-vis the environment. She writes, "During the past 2 years, the Bush administration, with remarkable single-mindedness, has set about undoing more than 30 years of work to protect the nation's air, water, and shrinking wilderness. Highlights of the administration's record, which read like a wish-you-were-here card to regulated industries, include encouraging road building through wildlife habitats, pushing tax cuts for energy exploration on public land, rejecting the Kyoto Treaty on global warming, and devising new rules that allow mining companies to fill in valleys and streams with waste. In recent months, the administration's anti-regulatory efforts have grown even more ambitious. Over the summer, the president unveiled his Healthy Forests Initiative, which, in spite of its cheery, public-spirited name, represents an attempt to open up more national forest land to the timber industry. Just a few weeks ago, the administration sent representatives to climate talks in New Delhi to argue that less effort should be devoted to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and more to preparing for the floods, droughts, and pestilence that are likely to follow from that policy. Sometime very soon, the Environmental Protection Agency is expected to issue new power plant rules that will absolve many older, dirtier plants from having to upgrade their equipment. It is generally assumed the administration held off on these rules so that they would not become public before the election." That's her list of actions that the administration is taking. Then she concludes the article by saying this, "Many of the decisions likely to be made over the next 2 years will have consequences that far outlast either President Bush or the new Congress. Once a forest is cut down, or a stream is filled in with waste, or a wildlife refuge is opened up to oil drilling, it's virtually impossible to undo the damage, at least in our lifetime, or our children's, or our children's children's. By now, we have become practically inured to these sorts of losses and depredations, skimming past news about the hole in the ozone, or the latest mysterious fish die-off, or the recent study warning that as many as half the planet's plant species are in danger of extinction. In the end, this may be the best way to understand an election like last week's," referring to the election of the first week in November, "and why the environment was not even an issue," end quote. So stepping back from that a moment, the first question, I think, is what does that reflect about the direction the administration would like to take us in? What's going on underneath this desire to do away with policies that protect the environment?
Well, I think that the Bush administration has been known, along with the Republican Party in general, as extremely friendly to corporate America, to those who are wealthy. And those are the people who make their fortunes through the exploitation of the environment, and who tend to downplay the potential damage that their actions will take. So it really should not be a surprise to any of us that this is the direction they're going, because they haven't even really given much of a nod to some of the environmental concerns. But what is shocking is really how they have ignored preponderance of evidence that their actions, or in many cases their lack of actions, will have these dire consequences. And scientific evidence is very clear that these actions will have deleterious effects on our environment, maybe even to the extent of wiping out the possibility of advanced life forms on this planet within a matter of decades. So it's a shocking thing, because it seems to ignore the wisdom of the experts. And what is even perhaps more shocking is that the American public, including us, haven't been able to articulate our sense of outrage that these things have been taking place.
I attended a conference this last week, part of which included a number of speakers addressing issues of globalization, including economic issues and ecological issues, from a religious perspective, the ethics of globalization and ethical economic life together and ecological life together. And one of the things I remember being said by a presenter is that never before in that person's known history, at least, has there been such a massive shift of wealth as there is today, and that's what our administration is about, participating in that massive shift of wealth upward to a very few people. And my sense is that, as Jim has just said, what's going on here at the very foundation is how to assist corporate giants to profit from that shift of wealth. One of my personal reflections, though, that I've thought about over the last few years is that I think there's been an enormous and significant paradigm shift that we're experiencing in our lifetime. And my sense of it is that if you look back over history, there's been the thought, the belief that the Earth is strong and powerful and can accommodate whatever we do to it. And a change has taken place. That paradigm has changed in our lifetime, I believe. And the balance has shifted. And I don't think the Earth is resilient enough to withstand the kinds of things we're doing to it anymore, or the numbers of people who are doing to it what's happening. So the capacity of the Earth to withstand the assault by humankind is diminishing, in my sense. And we have not caught up with that shift in arenas of leadership. So on the one hand, I think it is greed, corporate massive greed. And on the other hand, I think it's a failure to understand the significance of shifting paradigms of power.
It's amazing, to me at least, how how things do shift and drift in a culture in a way that is almost imperceptible to the casual observer, so that we don't see these things until we've reached a crisis. And I remember about 30 years ago reading for the first time in my life the things that you're just saying now, that that the Earth can't withstand the kind of assault that it is now receiving, and that in fact tremendously negative things will be happening because of the way we're treating the environment. And I remember having this feeling of loss and grief. And now, as I look back on that, I mean, this has been 30 years of having this feeling. I think we've all had it. But as I think about that, I think about it in the context of the idea of progress, which was one of the key words at the beginning of the 20th century, progress. What it meant, it would be probably hard to say, but there was some sense that life was going to get better and better and better and better. Now, underneath that, we might say, for the privileged, because certainly life has not gotten better and better for the vast majority of the world's peoples. But I think what we've discovered as we think about the environment and other issues today, public issues, is that progress has brought us to this point, and that we are now truly on the point of a crisis that is so difficult to imagine. It's very frightening. Jeff?
You know, to quote the Godfather, this is nothing personal, it's business. it really is. When I was in university, we were taught in our economics class the present value assessment of any expense. Today's dollar is worth a lot more than tomorrow's dollar. And we have this concept of present value embedded in our whole culture. Today, if we can make a dollar today, let's do it, and the heck with the consequences. If I can say something and get away with it and get elected today, that's much better than standing my ground on principle and maybe losing and coming back tomorrow. It's always today that's more important. Today the CEO introduces something without proper investigation as to its side effects on the environment or on people, but it's touted as a miracle drug, and the CEO knows that as soon as it hits the market, his stock value, his personal bonus, is going to go up another 20 million or 5 million. And like Michael Moore said, just how much is enough for you to make? And we do this at every stage. I was, as you were talking, I was thinking, in the Second World War, there was the siege of Stalingrad, I believe. That was, Stalingrad. Where the Nazis, the German army, surrounded the city, nothing went in or out. People were at a point of deprivation where there was even cannibalism going on. But you know one thing that we don't know very much about? The repository for potatoes for Russia was in that city. And the workers in that repository, the scientists and the workers, resolved to not touch any of those potatoes, in spite of the fact that people were reduced to cannibalism. Because they thought ahead. They thought this war, this siege is going to be over. We're going to need potato strains for this country. This is it. I was so impressed by that. And I wonder sometimes, just now, I was just sitting here wondering, if George Bush had been sitting there, he'd have said, the heck with that, let's make some stew. And it is tragic. That is what we're doing. It's our future strain of the potato that we're eating. Then they couch it in terms of patriotism. And you consider that in oil drilling in the Arctic and everywhere else. Now consider that oil is a resource globally that's going to be finished. Some say 100 years, some say 200. Let's just say 200 years. Would you rather be the last country to have oil, or would you rather run out of it and then be begging other countries for oil? Just on that basis alone, I would say put a cap on all the wells. Don't dig those wells at all. until we've sucked up the oil from all the other countries, and then we can say, all right, guys, we've got another 2 years' worth of oil here. But it's always today's dollar. And they couch it in the most patriotic terms, in business terms, in jobs. They talk about how they're trying to do this to make jobs. And all we've had is a resounding, plummeting crash towards unemployment. Mm-hmm. Don't get me started.
Mm-hmm. So it appears to us, at least, that from the point of view of public policy, what is going on here is a movement to make the accumulation of wealth for the few even more possible than it was before, at the expense of almost everything else, and for our purposes today, especially the environment, which is not only short-sighted, that is to say, it seems to have to do nothing with the future, it's the present. Mm-hmm. And this is disturbing, and will have long-term effects. Let's talk a little bit about the role of scripture from our traditions here, and ask ourselves what does scripture have to say to us about the protection of the earth, the role of the stewardship of the environment, and so forth. What do we find in Scripture? Jim?
Well, one of the basic messages of Scripture, and at least in the Jewish Hebraic tradition, is the idea that everything is from God and everything is of God. And it says in Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and all that is in it, the world and those who dwell therein. For it is God who founded it upon the seas and planted it firm upon the waters beneath. And so the whole idea that this is a holy place belongs to God, and we are to take care of it. It doesn't belong to us. And so just the basic concept that we have a holy and sacred task to preserve this God-given environment, and to make sure that whenever we leave this earth, individually and as a species, that it is in good stead, in good shape. So that, to me, is a basic concept that permeates this tradition. And obviously, we do have some power to build, to destroy, and we have to do it with a loving care. This is something that's very precious, and it's probably true that it's only been recently that we have gained the power through progress to make these monumental shifts in the environment and the ecology. And unfortunately, most of those things have had a negative effect. Now, it's true that some people might argue that the climate changes in the history, the billions of years of the Earth, have been very extreme, the ice ages, etc. But that was a natural part of the evolution of the Earth according to God's plan. But what we're doing by the innovations and the inventions that we brought is to change radically not only the Earth, but the environment around the Earth. And so the global warming is not just a term, but it could spell the end of life here on Earth. It's very, very frightening.
Yeah, the end of life as we know it. So if we are right about what we're saying about the Bush administration's policy on the environment, then we're also saying, as people of faith, that it goes against the teachings of our traditions. Sharon, you've been doing some thinking about this.
Jim's remarks reflect my understanding of the biblical language that's used in the first and the second creation stories in Genesis. And it seems to me that as in the Christian tradition, we've had a tendency to pay much more attention to the creation language from the first chapter of Genesis than we have to that language in the second chapter of Genesis. And I think probably to our detriment, we've paid more attention to Genesis 1, which instructs in the process of creation humanity to fill and subdue the earth. And the Christian interpretation of subdue has most often, in my opinion, had a character of domination and use. We could use the earth for whatever we choose because we are dominant as human beings on the earth. But there is the alternative language in the second chapter of Genesis, which says to till and to keep the earth. Humankind was given dominion of the earth. And the lovely thing about the Hebrew in that phrase is that the words used for to till and to keep, as we've translated them most often, also have the understanding of serving and preserving. And so it could just as well be translated to serve and to preserve. And the word serve in the Hebrew has the connotation of worship. This language in the second chapter of Genesis brings to my mind the sacredness of creation and the fact that we are to look at it as sacred, to obey, to listen to the earth and its needs, and to protect and preserve it. I think we in the Christian church would do well to be more attentive to that understanding of our task as stewards, as keepers, as preservers of this earth. It's like also Jim, what Jim said reminds me of the phrase, "Who's your mama?" You know, the earth is what provides us life, and as we continue to destroy it, to devastate it by our lust for wealth and power, we're killing the very foundation upon which we depend for life.
Jeff, what does the Quran have to say about stewardship of the environment? Does it say anything directly, or are there things that are contained in Scripture there which would indicate some sort of sensibility about the environment?
The teachings in Islam are always towards moderation of consumption. So in that sense, you can take it into the environment. God, again and again, has said he does not like gluttony or opulence or wasteful behavior. And everything must be consumed and used in moderation. So when you extend that, It just teaches you that you don't go in there and clear out five forests because you want lots of fire for a party or something. I mean, I'm making some ridiculous extensions here, but we do seem to be having one heck of a party. And when the rest of the world is harvesting their resources, when in Europe, they don't charge, by the way, they don't charge electricity or gas by electrical or gas units. They have heat units. And they charge you based on the heat units that you consume. And so everything, whatever source of energy you use, is reduced to energy. And that energy unit is what you're charged on, which I think makes good sense. But here we treat gas more casually than we treat water. How many times have we seen these huge behemoths standing there, A, with one person in it, and B, just idling for yeah. minutes and minutes and minutes, yeah. just idling, doing nothing. And so God cannot but look at us and say, don't do it. The other thing is, from a scientific point of view, I believe, it certainly looks to me like our administration seems to think there'll be plenty of warning bells before the great crash comes. But typically when you overload an environment, when you overload a certain situation, it keeps going. You've heard of the straw that broke the camel's back. Well, you keep heaping that environment with more and more abuse, and then finally that last iota of abuse you put on it, just suddenly the whole system comes crashing down. It happens in waters where oxygen is depleted, and suddenly, boom, all the fish die. And I think that's the way we might see it here if we're not careful.
So I think we're agreed that the public policy we're observing with regard to the environment is directly in contrast to our feelings about the sacredness of creation from our three different faith perspectives.
As well as all other religions.
Right, which makes this a moral issue as well as a public issue, which is one of the reasons we're talking about it, of course. I keep coming back to the question of why is this happening? What is it that's going on in the culture that permits this? And I keep remembering that wonderful, terrifying quote from Plato, who said, "What is honored in a culture will be cultivated." And so, lest we divide the world into the good and the bad and point a finger at someone else, it seems to me that the success of the Bush administration lies at least partially in our willingness, maybe at levels we're not aware of, to go along with this. And Sharon, you were saying before the program began that our unwillingness to let go of our private automobiles is a good example of that complicity, let's say, in the destruction of the environment. It's hard for us as Americans, I think especially, to let go of our privileges. And so that brings me really to the last question for today, which is, what can we as religious leaders do about this issue? What can we do to help people to understand the relationship between public policy, between the teachings and traditions of our faiths, and what is possible given that relationship?
I think that one really important part of it is education. Because I don't think that I myself or that the average American really has been able to distill, it's complex material, the dangers that are out there. So part of it is just letting people know and directing them where to go to find the information to really get the truth. Because if people don't know, ignorance is obviously no excuse, but if people don't know what the dangers are and really understand it, they're very unlikely to want to change their behaviors. So part of it is really that part of the cognitive piece, and I think that religion, that we have the bully pulpit, that we have a chance to speak to people. So it's our responsibility to become knowledgeable ourselves and then to communicate it clearly to the people who really, we hope, run the country, which is all of us. People can certainly question that reality. But knowledge is important. That's the first step.
One of the things we try to do in worship is to lift up both the sacredness of creation in all of its aspects and the desperate need of creation at this time for us to attend to its well-being. And making that a part of worship on a continuous, regular basis is one of the ways we're experiencing a way to address it.
Certainly preaching and teaching, being in touch with elected officials and writing for the newspaper, this radio program, these are all things that we can do to at least get our views into the public forum about the relationship between public policy and our faith beliefs and what actions we might take. Well, that's our program for this month. thanks to all our listeners, and join us again next month for another Step Down into Deep Water. This program was produced by Mike McCormick. Until next month, may God bless you and keep you.